So I want to do something a little different before we get into the podcast, because today is the 19th anniversary of the founding of SpaceX. And this book, Space Barons, is all about this different strategies that Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are using to go after almost the same goal. And if you happen to read the book and when you listen to the podcast, you'll see the importance of inspiration and influence. And so Jeff Bezos talks about, you know, he saw the landing on the moon when he was 5 years old, and it made an impression that he's never been able, that's never left him his entire life. Elon says very similar things. They talk about how inspiring NASA was when they were younger. They talked about the influence of reading of the books they read. The science, they were both obsessed with science fiction and wanted to make what seemed like dreams or fantasies in the novels they were reading actual reality. And so I want to read one of my favorite things that I do over and over again, especially to draw inspiration, is I go back and I listen to John F. Kennedy's, JFK's moon speech, which I think is one of the most important speeches any human has ever given. And so I'm going to read just a few, just before we get into today's preview, I just want to read a few quotes from the speech in case you're not familiar with it. And if you are, just as a refresher, I guess I should stop, pause for a second, just in case you're new to this feed. The feed that you're on, this is the public version of Founders. This is just like a sampler. It's every few days I post a preview. You can listen to, it's usually about the first 30 minutes of a podcast. Founders is a subscription podcast. It's ad-free. There's no intro music. There's no interviews. It's just the greatest ideas from biographies of entrepreneurs. One thing you'll learn if you study people like Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, I'm just naming the most well-known, the most famous ones. They all read biographies. They all looked for ideas used by other people that came before them to so they could apply it to their work. So I thought, hey, there should be a podcast that does this. So right now, if you sign up, if you subscribe, you immediately unlock 185 different episodes. And I add a new episode every week. And every single episode is about somebody that led a life that was so remarkable that somebody wrote a book about it. And so by listening to Founders, you're doing exactly what Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, all the greatest entrepreneurs in history did, which is they learn from biographies and they take those ideas and apply it to the work. So let me go back to this. I just want to read a few quotes from this. Oh, and if you want to sign up, you tap the link that's in your show notes in your podcast player. You can go to founderspodcast.com. And if you're new, just listen to a few previews. You'll clearly see why it's important to document the history of entrepreneurship and all the vast amount of useful information that you can learn really, really quickly and then apply that to your work and get a return on your investment. So let me go ahead and read a few quotes from here before we get into the beginning of what is just an amazing book, an absolutely amazing book, because you have two highly driven, highly intelligent, multi-billionaires going after similar goals. And so we can learn a lot from that. Okay, so let's go to JFK's moon speech. If you can listen to the whole thing, it's like 17 minutes long. I'm not obviously going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read highlights. And again, this all goes back to the importance of inspiration and how ideas, once they grab a hold of you, they can change your entire life. And you'll see that with the love of space and space and the allure of space exploration from both Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. All right, so JFK says, "We meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. The vast stretches of the unknown and the unanswered and the unfinished still far outstrip our collective comprehension. But condense, if you will, the 50,000 years of man's recorded history in a time span of but half a century. Stated in these terms, only 5 years ago, man learned to write and to use the wheel. The printing press came this year, and less than 2 months ago, Newton explored the meaning of gravity. Last month, electric lights and telephones and automobiles and airplanes became available. Only last week did we develop penicillin and television and nuclear power. This is a breathtaking pace. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardship, as well as high reward. So it's not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer to rest, to wait. But this country was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who moved forward, and so will space. all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties, and both must be enterprised and overcome with answerable courage. If this capsule of history of our progress teaches us anything, it is that man, in his quest for knowledge and progress, is determined and cannot be deterred. The exploration of space is one of the great adventures of all time. This generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it. We set sail on this new sea because there's new knowledge to be gained. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. The growth of our science and education will be enriched by new knowledge of our universe and environment, by new techniques of learning and mapping and observation, by new tools and computers for industry, medicine, the home, as well as the school. Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why he wanted to climb it. He said, "Because it's there." Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. In case you haven't, in a long time, I do highly recommend going to YouTube. You can see the whole speech. People have remastered it. They've increased the audio. His delivery is a lot better than what I just did there. But it really does speak to, and this is how it relates to the podcast and the book that we're going to talk about today. It really does speak to the importance of spreading ambition, of spreading inspiration. You have a speech by JFK that motivated an entire generation of scientists, engineers, astronauts. They wind up landing on the moon. That in turn inspires, you know, the child versions of Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, who work their entire lives and are still working to do this goal. And Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk in turn will inspire future generations to go after their goals, to do hard things, to get the most out of all their energies and skills. And I hope by listening to founders, you find ideas from the past that inspire your future. Some 50 years after the advent of the space age, no one had ever flown a rocket past the edge of space and landed it vertically. Now it had been performed twice in less than a month. The sight of the boosters standing on terra firma, scorched but triumphant, portended a sense of arrival and offered a hope for another Apollo 11 moment, the next giant leap many had felt they were promised but had never come. For decades, the first stages of rockets were ditched into the ocean after powering their payloads to space. To Musk and Bezos, this was an incredible waste, like throwing away an airplane after flying from New York to Los Angeles. Now they had shown that rockets could fly not just up, but back down, landing with precision and reigniting interest in human space in a way not seen in decades. Musk and Bezos were the leaders of this resurrection of the American space program, a pair of billionaires with vastly different styles and temperaments. Always audacious, Musk had plowed far ahead, his triumphs and failures commanding center stage. Bezos remained quiet and clandestine, his mysterious rocket venture kept hidden behind the curtain. At its heart, the story was fueled by a budding rivalry between the two leaders of the new space movement. The tension would play out in legal briefs and on Twitter, skirmishes over significance of their respective landings, and the thrust of their rockets, and even a dispute over the pad that would launch them. Musk, the brash hare, was blazing a trail for others to follow, while Bezos, the secretive and slow tortoise, who was content to take it step by step in a race that was only just the beginning. That was from the introduction of the book that I want to talk to you about today, which is The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and The Quest to Colonize the Cosmos by Christian Davenport. So today is going to be a little different. Normally each episode is focused on just a biography of one founder. And when I started reading Space Barons, my initial idea was to separate the ideas in this book into two separate podcasts. One was going to be on Jeff Bezos and his ideas, and the next was going to be on Elon Musk and his ideas. But what I realized after highlighting and organizing on my notes is that the book does such a great job of comparing and contrasting their styles. This theme that you just touched on in the introduction is present throughout the book, that Bezos is the tortoise and Musk is the hare, that I just decided, you know what? I'm going to combine them into one. All right, so let's get right into this book. Amazon's strategy was get big fast, luring customers with the convenience of the internet and low prices that the site was becoming known for. So this is, let me give you some context. This is right around 2003. Jeff Bezos, Amazon's already, you know, pretty successful, not nearly as successful as it is now in present day. He's taking some of the wealth that he generated from Amazon, and he started a rocket company called Blue Origin, which is what this book is about. And he's in Texas looking for, at the start of the book, he's in Texas looking for land, which is eventually going to be where he's going to build his, where they can build the rockets and launch them into space. And he's in a helicopter looking at land. He winds up almost dying in a helicopter crash. The chapter is actually called A Silly Way to Die, which is a quote that Jeff Bezos said went through his mind while the crash was happening, that this is such a dumb way if I died. So that's just the context. So this is happening in early 2003 is where we're at right now in the book. Okay, so it says, despite the get-rich-quick hype that had surrounded so many internet startups, Amazon took a slow and steady approach, keeping its prices low, offering free shipping, even while critics said it would never work. In headlines during the late 1990s, Business Week had derided the company as Amazon.toast, and Barron's called it Amazon.bomb, with an unflattering photo of Bezos, which showed it to an audience and said, "My mom hates this picture." So that's Bezos talking to an audience. But by early 2003, with sales in every major segment growing by double digits, Bezos was as confident as ever in the company's approach. So I want to stop there again. Something we talk about on every single podcast and every single biography that we read about founders is something very important for you to internalize, is that if you're going to do anything, you have to be expected to be criticized. And just understand that some of those criticisms may be valid, but a lot of them are not. And it doesn't matter if they're valid or they're not. You just have to know that they're going to be present. How silly does Business Week and Barron's look now, 20 years later, saying, oh, you know, this guy's crazy, it's not going to work out, Amazon.toast, Amazon.bomb. He's the richest person in the world, and Amazon, I think, just passed $1 trillion market cap. It amazes me as us humans will constantly talk, even if we don't know what we're talking about, or constantly think that we have the ability to predict the future when we just don't. It's easy to internalize when you're reminded by it week after week and you see these just gross examples. The one I always use is where Sam Walton's working at JCPenney and his manager's like, oh, Sam, you need to quit. Like, you're not made out for retail. And he goes on and becomes the world's biggest retailer. Like, it's something that I think founders have to deal with. We have our own issues managing our own mental health and like the doubts and the struggles of building a business and building companies. And just know that, you know, externally, people are not going to make it easier. So if Jeff Bezos had to deal with it, you're certainly going to have to deal with it too. All right. So it says, but by early 2003, with sales in every major segment growing by double digits, Bezos was as confident as ever in his company's approach. It's working, he said. It's the right investment to make, and it's in the long-term best interest of shareholders and our customers. So what I love about this book is there's tons. Christian Davenport actually interviewed four billionaires for this book. He spent time with Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Richard Branson, and Paul Allen. I've completely omitted all the parts about Richard Branson and Paul Allen because they're outside of our scope, but there's a lot of direct quotes from these guys in here, which I think is very valuable when you can hear them speak directly. The iPhone was still 4 years away, but from its debut, the iPhone was still four years away from its debut, but he was confident that the internet was really only just getting started. Compared to the, I love this comparison I've heard him make a couple times. He compared it, meaning Jeff Bezos compared the internet, compared it to the early days of the electrical industry. The web in 2003 was about where the electrical industry was in 1908, he argued, when the electric socket hadn't yet been invented and appliances had to be plugged into light sockets. Now he's saying this in 2003. Think about what AWS has become in present day. If you really do, and Amazon in general is a platform for other merchants, if you really do believe it's the very, very beginning, he said, then you're incredibly optimistic. And I do think that's where we are. I think we're seeing this in a personally in a number of other industries, all sprung out on top of the internet, podcasts being one of them. March 2003 was, then, a good time to go looking for real estate, to allow himself a measure of freedom to indulge in his true passion, even if he rarely spoke of it. He's going to talk a lot about passions in this book, which I think is enlightening for the rest of us. Okay, so this, he's announcing Blue Origin, and he's defending NASA. So again, some of this is going to be like a refresher course for those that have listened to the original Jeff Bezos podcast I did. So it says he was buying all of the land for his space company, a little-known venture called Blue Origin, based outside Seattle. Since its founding in 2000, Bezos had kept the company extremely secret, telling virtually no one what its plans were. The company wasn't listed in the phone book. Its employees told neighbors they were working on scientific research. And one industry official told The Economist that everyone I know who knows anything about it isn't allowed to talk about it, and please, please don't quote me on that. So what happens is, the reason I say that a lot of this is familiar is because Brad Stone, the author of that great book, he's a young reporter at Newsweek at the time, he winds up going around like in the trash outside of Blue Origin and discovering documents for the original LLC they filed, and then he finds like documents saying that they want to create an enduring presence in space. So he emails Jeff Bezos. He's like, what's going on here? So this is Jeff's response. Stone reached out to Bezos for comment, but Bezos declined to elaborate on Blue Origin's goal for Stone's Newsweek story. It's way too premature for Blue to say anything or comment on anything because we haven't done anything worthy of comment, Bezos wrote in an email. He did, however, seek to dispel one falsehood, that somehow he was doing this out of a frustration with NASA, which many had criticized for going backward after the Apollo moon missions. NASA is a national treasure, and it's total bull that anyone should be frustrated by NASA, he wrote. This is Jeff talking, obviously. The only reason I'm interested in space is because they inspired me when I was 5 years old. How many government agencies can you think of that inspire five-year-olds, Bezos asked. Bezos was five when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon in 1969. Okay, so this is a great... the note I left myself is, why don't you start it today? And then also Bezos and his idea that you have to accept wild ideas. So Bezos is friends with the science fiction writer Neal Stephenson. And it says, in 1999, Bezos and Stephenson went to see a matinee. Afterward, in a coffee shop, he said... And this is Neil talking about the conversation he had with Jeff. He said that he had always wanted to start a space company. And I said, well, why don't you start it today? Why not start it today? What was he waiting for? He'd been fascinated with space his whole life, and now he was finally in a position to do something about it. Things started immediately after that. I think that's important because a lot of us, you know, everybody, I think almost everybody suffers from some level of procrastination. And if you just ask yourself constantly, why don't you start it today? You'll realize that most of the reasons you have for not doing it are just excuses. Their first goal was to explore other ways of getting to space besides using chemical rockets, a technology that hadn't improved much in the four previous decades. For the first 3 years, we exhaustively looked at every known alternative to chemical rockets, and we even invented some previously unthought of alternatives to chemical rockets, Bezos said. I should know by now it's pronounced Bezos, but I fall back to the wrong pronunciation. Please forgive me. You know, if you've listened to this podcast for a long time, I can barely pronounce anything in English for some reason. To develop a whole new technology, they'd consider any possibility, no matter how crazy it sounded. When you're brainstorming, you have to accept wild ideas, Bezos said. And he's going to expound on that idea on the very next page. After 3 years of research, Bezos and his small team ultimately decided that chemical rockets actually are the best solution. They're not just a good solution, they're actually an awesome solution for launch. But there was a caveat. They had to be reusable. Rockets had been, to this point, largely expendable. The first stages would boost their payloads into space, separate, and fall back to Earth, where they would crash into the ocean, never to be used again. This whole idea where rockets fall into the ocean, later on, Bezos becomes obsessed with collecting space memorabilia, and he actually hires the team, an expedition to go into the Atlantic Ocean, and he spends like 3 weeks on the boat with them. They wind up successfully recovering the engines that fell from the Saturn V rocket, which is pretty crazy because they just sat at the bottom of the ocean for 40 years. Okay, so it said they were like honeybees sacrificing their lives to use their stinger a single glorious time, all in to the death. But what if rockets didn't need to be that way? What if they could fly again and again like airplanes instead of ditching into the depths of the ocean where they would corrode and waste away? This, Bezos thought, was the solution they had been searching for. Blue intended to build rockets that would take three passengers or more on suborbital flights to the edge of space. The story didn't use the phrase space tourism, but that's what Bezos was describing and what he had in mind. Blue's rockets would also do something different, something no rocket had ever done before. After blasting off from the launch pad, they would land vertically. Reusable rockets were a dream that had eluded the space community for years. The government had tried this and failed. So again, at the present time, when this is happening, this is considered a wild idea. There had been a very mature space industry for over 40 years. Why had no one ever done this? And the other note on the next page is, what is different now compared to when this idea was first was last tried? And we're kind of seeing examples of this in present day where the technology, let's say there was a lot of ideas in like the original dot-com bubble that didn't work out, that now 15 years later have actually worked out because the technology and the markets are much larger. So they realize that, hey, there's a lot of stuff that have changed in the last 40 years that we can just apply if we start from scratch. And it says, how is this situation in the year 2000 different from 1960? What has changed? These are questions they're asking themselves. And I think this is really good for entrepreneurs and founders to constantly re-examine their own line of thinking. Like, let me not just keep, this is not like a linear progression. Like, what started, if I just start from scratch, like what is different now? Are there ideas that failed in the past that can work now? And they're applying this to rocket technology, but I think it can apply to, you know, infinite number of things. The engines can be somewhat better, but they're still chemical rocket engines. What's different is computer sensors, cameras, and software. Being able to land vertically is the kind of problem that can be addressed by those technologies that existed in 2000 that didn't exist in 1960. That's such an important idea. The revolution would begin in West Texas, where Bezos would eventually acquire 331,000 acres. That's nearly half the landmass of the state of Rhode Island. When you're building a rocket and launching rockets, it's nice to have a bit of a buffer, he said. He had that and more. A ranch for his family, not unlike his grandfather's in South Texas. Remember this part. This is very important. Where he'd spent summers and learned the value of self-reliance. A place to launch and land rockets, large enough to hold even the biggest of dreams. A place to stretch out toward the stars. That's just really good writing. Okay. So we're going to skip ahead. And now we're going to enter. So, like I said, they go back and forth between... They weave in the stories. The author does a beautiful job of weaving in these stories of Elon and Jeff back and forth, to where it's obvious, like the compare and contrast between these two guys, it just smacks you in the face. Okay, so this is going to be a brief Elon bio. I mean, I kind of feel silly because I think a lot of people know this, but maybe they don't. Okay, so Musk was, in many ways, like a younger version of Beal. Okay, so Beal is this guy, Andy Beal. Andy, I'm not going to say he was like Elon before Elon, because Elon, like I said, he's like a one in a million or one in a billion or whatever, one in 7 billion. But he was a very eccentric billionaire with a very interesting life story, something I didn't know that much about, who spent $100 million of his own money trying to privatize rocket technology. So a lot of like, think of this. This is the crazy part. SpaceX takes over this rocket facility in McGregor, Texas. That was Andy Beal's like 10 years before SpaceX got it, or maybe like 5 years. I forgot the exact time frame. It's not really important. But SpaceX winds up getting like a rocket launch site, a test stand, and I forgot how many thousands of acres for like $45,000 a year, just because Beal had to close up shop and it was just rotting away. So anyways, he's a very fascinating guy in his own right, because he's just a fascinating. He's got like a crazy life story. So anyways, Musk, you're going to see Beal mentioned in this. I just want to give you some background so you're not like, who the hell is this guy? And you didn't tell me who it was. So Musk was in many ways like a younger version of Beal. Instead of repairing and reselling televisions, he's talking about what Beal did like when he was a kid. Musk's childhood entrepreneurial streak led him to try to open a video arcade when he was 16 with his brother Kimball in their hometown of Pretoria, South Africa. But they were stopped by the city because of a zoning issue. Elon had a rough childhood and a strained relationship with his father. It was clear that from a young age he was exceptional, and his mother sent him to school early, making him the youngest and smallest in his class, a prime target for bullies. It's a rough culture. Imagine rough. Well, it's rougher than that.
kids gave Elon a very hard time, and it had a huge impact on his life. One story that's in Ashley Vance's great book on Elon Musk, I think they also talk about it in this one, is Elon got jumped by a bunch of bullies one day. They put him in a hospital, and this kind of just solidified his his introvertness, I think is the way to put it. He would just spend his time working on computers and reading books instead. So this is the brief bio for those that don't already know, but he started a company called Zip2 that would help print newspapers get their content online, and immediately had customers lining up from the New York Times to Hearst. Musk sold the company to Compaq in 1999 for $300 million, big difference. His next venture was called X.com, an online bank that merged with PayPal. eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion, netting Musk $180 million. He was 31 years old. So he sells his first company for $300 million. I think he makes like $30 million out of the deal. He's in his late 20s. By the time he's 31, he makes another $180 million. Even before the sale, Musk was thinking about what he wanted to do next, what benefit he would make to the future of humanity. Beale had said he wanted his efforts to contribute to people's ability to stretch out into the stars and to stay. Musk, too, thought something needed to be done. What if the sun burned out or an asteroid hit Earth? So now I want to get into... I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but this is Musk's thinking on space, and we're going to get a lot of insight into just his brain here. So he said, Musk began thinking seriously about the question and the probability of an eventual extinction event, as he called it. The solution? Find another planet to live on. Make humans a multi-planet species and create a backup hard drive for the computer race for the human race there, just in case Earth crashes like a faulty computer. What I love about the way Elon thinks, if you hear him talk, and I've read now multiple books on him. I read all of Tim Urban's, I think it's like 70,000 words he wrote about Elon on the Wait But Why blog. If you haven't read it, you can read it for free online. It's amazing. He compares a lot, like the brain in your brain is basically software to the hardware. Like the analogy he uses a lot is, okay, so the software is to hardware what your brain is to your body. And this idea where he's like, oh, well, you know, looking at the human race, like we just need to make a backup. Like, I just think that's a really interesting idea. The best bet, he thought, is to colonize Mars. One night he was driving home from a party on Long Island to New York City with his college friend, Adio Ressi. Now this is going to be Adio talking. We were both interested in space, but we dismissed it as soon as it came up. Like, oh, that's too expensive and complicated. Then 2 miles would go by. Well, how expensive and complicated could it be? 2 more miles. It can't be that expensive and complicated. That night, Musk went back to his hotel and logged onto the NASA website, looking for the plan to get Mars. Because, of course, there had to be a schedule, he said. And I couldn't find it. I thought the problem was me. Because, of course, it must be here somewhere on this website. But it was just well hidden. It wasn't on the website because there wasn't a schedule. Musk, a ravenous reader of science fiction, had expected by this point in his life that there would be a base on the moon and trips to Mars powered by the robust space program built on the Apollo lunar missions. If in the 1960s the United States could get a man to the moon in less than a decade, surely there were great things to come. He was overcome with what he called a feeling of dismay. I did not want Apollo to be our high water mark. We went backwards, and that is a great tragedy. So he does what he always does. When he wants to learn something, he says, Musk had read every book he could find on the subject, as Beale had, and he came away convinced that the best way to acquire a rocket was to build it himself. And again, before I finish the sentence, remember what I just said about the criticism Bezos was getting. He was convinced that the best way to acquire a rocket was to build it himself, no matter how many times friends told him he was crazy. He shared the banker's zeal. They're talking about banker because Beale later in his life started his own bank, and that made him a billionaire. He shared the banker's zeal of lowering the cost of space travel and decided he'd try to upend the government-dominated business model that Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop, and others had been feasting on for years. On March 14, 2002, Musk incorporated Space Exploration Technologies. Many of his close friends felt they needed to stage an invention. A billionaire with no experience in space could not start up a rocket company and a manned space program. Just ask Andy Beale. Okay, we're going to skip ahead. Musk builds his rocket, and this part is about how Musk gets NASA's attention. Musk had built a rocket in just over a year. He couldn't get anyone at NASA to pay attention. By the end of 2003, Musk decided that if NASA wouldn't come to him, he would go to it. The FAA was preparing to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first powered flight with a party at the National Air and Space Museum, and Musk decided he'd show up and bring his new rocket. In case you're a new listener to Founders, I did a podcast on the Wright brothers also. It's based on David McCullough's great book on the Wright brothers. That book is like a 200-page book. I think you can read in a day. Let's call it 2 days. I think every entrepreneur should read that book because it teaches you about a level of resourcefulness that I think is handy to everybody. They literally created powered flight with the profits of a very small bicycle business. And just the resourcefulness of Wilbur Wright, Orville Wright too, both of them, but especially Wilbur, it's just, I don't know, it's a great book. Okay, so for the event, SpaceX loaded the 7-story rocket onto the back of a custom trailer and hauled it across country to Washington, D.C. So he's got this 70-foot-long rocket on the back of a trailer, and they're driving it to Washington, D.C. As Musk, then 32 years old, parked his rocket outside the headquarters of the FAA, tourists who were headed to the National Air and Space Museum stopped to gawk at the street-side exhibit. A shiny white missile that stretched 7 stories long, squatting in real estate usually reserved for hot dog vendors. He wasn't just selling his rocket, but what it represented. The crazy idea, and it is a crazy idea, that a small startup could succeed in space. Beale had gotten further than many had thought, and he put a nice dent in the wall that kept untraditional players out of the space business. But if Musk was going to avoid Beale's fate, he didn't just have to build reliable rockets. He had to upend the industry's entrenched hierarchy. That would take more than just sound engineering. It would take bravado and guts. A delusion fueled by ego, luck, and an appetite to fight the establishment relentlessly. What they're talking about there is an appetite to fight. I wonder if the bullying that Elon suffered early in life kind of manifests itself later in life when he had access to resources and more power, because as you'll see in this book, he picks fights with basically the military industrial complex of the United States, which it's just mind-boggling to me. Okay, so I'm gonna skip to the next chapter. There's some interesting parts in here that I learned from. So this is where NASA visits space after that stunt. He got their attention, so they finally visit SpaceX, and we're gonna get some more insights into Elon's personality. And it says, when they walked through the doors of Musk's shop, the quartet, I mean, there's 4 guys from NASA, became the first NASA officials ever to visit SpaceX's headquarters. It was unlike any rocket company they had ever seen. Employees had set up ping pong and air hockey tables and rode around on a Segway. Musk would drive his $1 million McLaren F1 sports car through the hangar door close to his cubicle right onto the factory floor. But the employees were doing real work, building engines and hardware. They looked around at the small team that was just then, that it was only 42 employees, most engineers and technicians. He saw some faces he recognized from some of the top aerospace companies in the world. Aggressive hiring, they noted in their report. Highly talented, hand-picked team. Most of all, they were impressed with Musk, who was surprisingly fluent in rocket engineering and understood the science of propulsion and engine design. Musk was intense, preternaturally focused, and extremely determined. This was not the kind of guy who was going to accept failure, they remember thinking. So he makes friends with this guy Sarsfield, who's part of the people that from NASA that went to visit him. Once Musk built a relationship with him, he's constantly like lighting him up with questions. And so this I thought was funny. This is the insight into his personality. And it says, he sends text in a constant flow, Sarsfield recalled. I found him to be consumed by whatever was in front of him and anxious to solve problems. This, combined with a tendency to work 18 hours a day, is a sign of someone driven to succeed. Most of us struggle with fear, Sarsfield said. We fret about this and that and generally dread looking dumb. I found Elon fearless in this regard. He was not afraid to ask a question that proves he doesn't understand something, which I think is helpful for all of us to adopt. The world is far too complex for any one human or all of humanity combined, for that matter, to actually understand this world that we found ourselves living in. So this idea that you'd be afraid to ask questions because you like people are going to think you're dumb. No one knows everything. Like, it, I don't know. I just asking questions, I think, to me, is a sign of intelligence, not the opposite. Okay, so this is, remember how the author is comparing, you know, the hair, the crazy hair is just going, you know, headlong, just running as fast as he can, like kicking up dust and making a mess. Elon winds up suing NASA. So he says NASA had just awarded a $227 million sole source contract to another commercial space company, Kistler Aerospace. Musk wanted to know why SpaceX or any other company hadn't been allowed to bid on it. So he gets a response from NASA, says, hey, you know, don't worry, there's going to be other things in the future. But this, the guy that's running Kistler, he was part of the Apollo. This guy named George Mueller, he was an aerospace legend. He ran the Office of Manned Spaceflight during the Apollo era. He does all this other stuff. So basically what Musk finds out is there's just an element of crony capitalism. The system is rigged. Why did they give him a $227 million sole source contract? Was it because they were the best commercial space company? No. The sentence I'm going to read you could induce somebody into a state of rage. The young company, meaning Kistler Aerospace, the young company was in trouble and had filed for bankruptcy in 2003, owing $600 million to creditors. The NASA contract would help it stay afloat. That is not a good use of taxpayer dollars. So Musk was incensed and felt that the contract was unfair, if not illegal. Like Andy Beal, he felt that NASA's role wasn't to prop up chosen companies. Musk took his complaint to top NASA officials, and in a meeting at NASA headquarters in Washington, he threatened to file a legal challenge over the no-bid contract with the Government Accountability Office, so the GAO. I was told by everyone, you do not sue NASA, Musk recalled. I was told the odds of winning a protest were less than 10%, and you don't sue your potential future customers. I was like, look, this is messed up. This shouldn't have been this should have been a competed contract, and it wasn't. So this, there's a quote that I love. It's from Gwynne Shotwell, who's the president of SpaceX. And it says, Elon fights for the right thing. And he says if people are going to get offended by you fighting for the right thing, then they are going to get offended. From the beginning, now this is an important part too, because this is constantly, what we're about to learn right here, this one sentence is constantly referenced in the book, and they contrast it with the motto of Blue Origin. From the beginning, SpaceX's mantra was to set audacious, nearly impossible goals and don't get dissuaded. And this is the part. Head down, plow through the line. So this whole head down, plow through the line, that's something that's repeated at SpaceX. The GAO, which oversaw the protest, a couple pages later, we find out that Elon was actually right to do this. So it says the GAO, which oversaw the protest, forced NASA to withdraw the contract. SpaceX had won. NASA would later open up another contract, and at this time, SpaceX could compete. That, and this is now Musk talking, that victory with the GAO was important for the future of SpaceX. So skipping ahead, now we're going to go back to Jeff. Nearly 500 miles to the west, on the land he had purchased clandestinely, Bezos was quietly building his own rocket company. Obsessed with secrecy, he was as quiet and slow as Musk was loud and fast. While Musk thrust his rocket under the spotlight on Independence Avenue, Bezos kept his company's work hidden. So the tortoise and the hare are actually going to meet for dinner. This is, well, let's just go right to it. We talked about rocket architectures, Musk later recalled. It was very clear technically he was barking up the wrong tree, and I tried to give him the best advice I could. Some of the engine architectures they were pursuing were the wrong evolutionary path. Some of the ideas that Bezos proposed, SpaceX had already tested. Musk said, dude, we tried that and it turned out to be really dumb. So I'm telling you, don't do the dumb thing we did, he recalled saying. I actually did my best to give good advice, which he largely ignored. So this interesting part about him largely ignoring kind of goes back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, that Bezos believed that you have to try wild ideas, even if other people failed at them before. Unlike Musk, Bezos wasn't in a rush. He was happy to experiment and fail, to try new ideas, even if they had been tried before and went nowhere. Bezos had had vast amounts of patience. This was a man who was, after all, building a 10,000-year clock inside of a mountain on his West Texas property that would be a symbol, a an icon for long-term thinking, he had written. So they're talking about I think it's called the Clock of the Long Now. I listened to a podcast about it, and then I actually went to the website and read about it, I think sometime last year. It's interesting. I'd look into it if you have a few minutes. This sentence sticks out to me. Bezos had a vast amount of patience. I don't know. I think that's like a superpower. I really do, the more I learn about this guy. They talk about he went to a Montessori preschool. If you know, they jump from like subject to subject, kind of letting the kid learn about little different things at their own pace. Well, when he was a kid, the teachers literally like, it goes from like station to station, right? So your kid is there maybe 3-4 years old in one station working as they, playing as they want. And then eventually teachers say, okay, now move to the next station. They would literally, Bezos would have so much patience and so much concentration, they'd have to pick him up and move him to the next station. I find that very fascinating. Despite the seemingly plodding steps he would take, he had a sense of urgency and a direction. Only, as he said, you get there faster when you take one step at a time. The company's motto was, it's something in Latin that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but the important part is what it translates to, and that's step by step, ferociously. Perhaps none of its symbols were more important than a pair of turtles reaching up toward the stars, an homage to the winner of the race between the tortoise and the hare. The turtle was Blue Origin's mascot. I love this saying too. The embodiment of another of one of Bezos' favorite sayings, one derived from U.S. Navy SEAL training. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. It was the opposite of SpaceX's head down, plow through the line. Now Musk and Bezos were playing the parts in a modern version of Aesop's fable. The hare had burst forward, dashing ahead, kicking up a tumultuous plume of dust, while the tortoise creaked slowly, uttering softly in an I think I can cadence. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Slow and smooth is fast. Okay. Oh, so this is... Okay, so there's going to be... I love hearing stories. One of my passions besides entrepreneurship and reading and podcasts is history. And so there's a great deal about space history in this book. I really hope after I'm done with this podcast, you guys buy this book because it was really, really, the author just did a fantastic job. And there's so much of the book that is not, obviously not going to make it into the podcast, I think is worth reading. Okay, so this is about a giant circle, and this just blew my mind. So let me read it to you. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. You're hearing this because you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed, and so you're only hearing partial episodes of Founders. In this case, you heard the first 30, 35 minutes of this episode. This episode goes on for much longer. It's about an hour and a half in length. If you'd like to finish listening to this episode, you can upgrade by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player. It's, I think, 2 taps in less than 30 seconds, and you can install the Founders Misfit feed on your favorite podcast player. You'll immediately unlock 185 full-length episodes that are available nowhere else. And I also add at least one episode every week. I'm actually doing a deep dive into Jeff Bezos. So over the next 10 days, there'll be 3 new episodes about 3 books on the life and career of Jeff Bezos. And every episode that is covered on the Founders Misfit feed is about the life story of a person who led such a remarkable life that somebody wrote a book about it. I'm going to read just a list of some of the people that I've read biographies on. So you'll be learning from people like Walt Disney, John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Frank Lloyd Wright, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Andrew Carnegie, Leonardo da Vinci, the Wright brothers, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Enzo Ferrari, Levi Strauss, Coco Chanel, Larry Ellison, Richard Branson, and many more. You also learn from the founders of companies like Nike, Rolls-Royce, IBM, Home Depot, Atari, General Motors, Cadillac, Patagonia, Adidas, IKEA, Sony, and just so many, many more. Many great people in history, some of the smartest, most productive people to ever live, took time out of their schedules to read biographies and learn from the great people that came before them. By upgrading, you'll be doing the exact same thing. Mark Andreessen said it best when he was telling an audience why he spent so much time reading biographies. He said, there are thousands of years in history in which lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology.
They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these lessons down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of your time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. And that last line, for very little money and a few hours of your time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience, could be a description of Founders. Right now, you can lock in the lowest price Founders will ever be. It is less than a dollar a week. It's actually 94 cents a week. So upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or by going to founderspodcast.com.